biggest black boxes between the ears of a fundamental manager quite often. So I'm not a huge fan of that label, strategic investment, but a typical minimum ticket size is in the 100 million range. One of the main reasons why we insist on a site visit is because we want to read body language.
Yeah. AI is everywhere in the conversation, but nowhere in the execution.
Spend less time trying to predict markets, more time trying to understand people. For quant AI-driven managers, the bar for governance, robustness, and explainability rises sharply when something like AI is core to the strategy.
Welcome to Against Consensus, a weekly podcast in collaboration with FinNews. I'm your host, Angelo Calvello, and in each 30-minute episode, I interview asset owners, asset managers, service providers, and innovators who are challenging conventional thinking to create better investment outcomes for their beneficiaries and clients. Our goal is to elevate the conversation and help you make smarter investment decisions, always with a little edginess along the way. Welcome to another episode of Against Consensus. My guest today is Sebasis Das, a senior portfolio manager in strategic alternative investments at the Florida State Board of Administration, one of the largest public pension funds in the country. Sebasis has been building and running one of the most rigorous manager selection processes in institutional investing. In our conversation, we get into the composition and the purpose of the portfolio, how he and his team source, vet, and construct a portfolio that spans hedge funds, infrastructure, insurance-linked securities, and opportunistic strategies. We talk about the specific vetting criteria he applies to hedge funds, how consultants fit into the process, and what happens when a fully autonomous AI black box walks into a pitch meeting. We also get into what 2 decades of site visits have taught him about things you cannot put into a spreadsheet and why those things might be more important than anything else. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did. Sebasis Das, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I had the pleasure of sharing a panel with you not too long ago, and what struck me was, honestly, your depth of knowledge and your breadth of experience. And plus, we're not going to mention you have a PhD because that's always a problem. But, you know, we ran out of time in our, you know, with our time together, and we couldn't get all to all the topics we had planned to. So that caused me to reach out to you and invite you to record an episode of Against Consensus. I'm glad you said yes, and I'm looking forward to picking up where we left off.
Yeah. Thank you, Angela. I really appreciate it.
So let's start with a couple warm-up questions. Early bird or night owl?
Early bird.
Yeah, definitely. Cricket or football?
Football as in American football or soccer? Soccer.
Hey, we're in the middle of FIFA. We'll put a timestamp on this. What do you think?
Cricket is something I grew up playing, so I'm a little biased towards it. But the World Cup is something else. I, along with everybody else watching yesterday, I cut out early to go see the France game.
Well, you'll be leaving early today again, I guess, right?
Yes,
we got Spain today, so that'll be exciting. Your training as an economist or your training as a computer scientist, which shaped your investment thinking more?
I tend to think that it's more my economist training. Financial economics was definitely an interest of mine. I even considered at one point moving over to the finance discipline formally, but did not end up doing so. I think as an economist background, I think what that gives you is a sort of a big picture view of the landscape as opposed to getting lost in the weeds of specific market regimes or market incidents. It sort of shapes your views on how to evaluate an overall market or overall regime that currently you're going through within the your portfolio and what your portfolio is subject to.
I mean, you know, talking about getting lost in the weeds, I'm feeling that's like a critique of my PhD in philosophy. So, I caught that. I know what you're going there. All right, final one. There's a new strategy that somebody presents to you. Are you a first mover or a fast follower?
We tend not to be a first mover. If it's a public market strategy, normally I and the rest of the team would prefer to see at least a 2 to 3 year track record before we can dive into deep diligence. If the strategy had existed as a part of a bigger multi-strat or anything like that, if you can show us a carve out, that might work. But we do, for a public market strategy, it has to have a bit of a track record, hopefully 3 years, but somewhere in there.
Then you're neither a first mover nor a fast follower.
Right.
No. None of the above.
Yeah. The problem, Angelo, really comes from the fact, look, we can't really invest $25 million in something. It's not going to move the third decimal place of returns. And so we have to go in size. A typical minimum ticket size is in the $100 million range. And to do that, I need to be able to convince the powers that be that, look, this is what the strategy does. This is the results that have happened in X and Y market circumstances and all of that good stuff. And it's hard for us to do that.
I get it. I mean, you know, you're right there with your peers. It's not as if some of your, you know, the large peers would say, oh, I'm going to give somebody a $10 million allocation. It's just not worth the time to do the diligence.
That's exactly right.
Well, you've kind of taken us into where I want to start, and that's just with a little bit of background. You're the senior PM in the strategic, and I think you do it this way, alternative, you put the parentheses up, investments, you know, for the State Board of Florida. What does that mean? What the hell do you do for a living?
I'm not a huge fan of that label, strategic investment, but I can go over exactly what that means. So coming out of the GFC, this group was originally conceived of as all of alternatives except PE and real estate equity, which we have two groups at the fund doing those two things for a fairly long period of time. So it goes across private, it used to go across private credit, hedge funds, you name it, transportation, anything that doesn't fit into the traditional asset classes plus PE and real estate equity sort of came to us. What now happened was over time, private credit grew to be a huge part of what we did. In fact, more than 50% at one point. So the powers that be then decided to spin out private credit into a new asset class called active credit, which also includes public credit in the shape of loans, high yield, and EM debt. So today, as we sit, what we cover are all of alls, excluding those things, PE, private credit, real estate equity, and we consist of mainly the current composition crosses four major verticals: hedge funds to 2%, infrastructure 1%, ILS or insurance-linked securities up 1%, and an opportunistic bucket of up to 5%. So we tend to think of these verticals as sub-asset classes, which we are then aggregating up to form the total portfolio. But we manage each of these sub-asset classes separately with their own objectives and so on and so forth. But the overall tenor of the asset class is still invest in things which represent diversification from risks that dominate the rest of the pension fund, which, as you would guess, like most pension funds, tends to be dominated by equity risk.
So that would be the objective,
yes,
of this allocation is diversification.
Correct. The formal objectives are three: reduce total fund volatility and improve risk-adjusted returns, outperform during significant market declines, increase flexibility by being able to invest in non-traditional and opportunistic strategies which don't fit into the other normal asset classes.
Since you kind of got specific there about what the objective is, let's talk about, you know, hedge funds for a minute. They fall, you know, under your jurisdiction. Do you have specific criteria that you apply in the manager selection, manager review process? I mean, you're a quant. I assume that you have some kind of metrics you must look at beyond the 2 to 3 years. That's kind of just a baseline, the 2 to 3 years. So how do you think about this when you're looking at hedge funds? What are you looking for?
Let me step back a little bit and as I said, each vertical is managed with separate risk-return objectives. So specifically for hedge funds, what we have a return objective of SOFR plus 300 bips. Okay. But in addition to that, the objective also is to be 0.5 or lower correlated with the rest of the fund and have less than 25% downside capture when in a market decline. So that kind of shapes how we put the overall portfolio of portfolios together. What that shakes out in practical terms is at least 75% of the hedge fund portfolio is focused on diversifying strategies such as fixed income RV, CTAs, global macro, equity market neutral. So as you can guess, I mean, the objective there is to have as low market exposure as possible. And then we also have up to 25% more directional, more growthier type of strategies, such as long-short equity, long-short credit. We may have some event-oriented funds, things that have a lot more directionality compared to the diversifying strategy. So the two together, then we think allows us to have a fair shot at beating SOFR plus 300 bips over a complete market cycle.
Everybody always adds over a complete market cycle.
Yeah.
It's kind of our heads there.
It's the mythical range of a market cycle is, I hear you on that.
So you have, you know, designated allocations into certain groupings within the overall alternative portfolio. Tell me about the team. I'm sure there's more than just you doing this.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, you're a smart guy, but let's be honest.
So the team is overseen by a senior investment officer who reports directly to the CIO. And then within the team, we have three senior PMs, one assistant PM, one investment analyst, and one operations analyst. All of the PMs are generalists in the sense that they can go across verticals. So me, for example, I do a lot of the hedge funds, but I oversee some infrastructure funds, some of the ILS funds, and so on and so forth. So we've deliberately kept it generalist in the sense that we feel that for the team to have a meaningful conversation about any fund, all of us need to have some understanding of the different verticals. People may gravitate towards one, but they have responsibilities across all the verticals. I mean, people, like I came from the equity side. And so if there's some quantitative equity strategy, then that's how you'll probably ask me to take a look. I may or may not end up doing it. But so basically, people tend to gravitate towards things they have a background in, but we have responsibilities across the verticals.
Walk me through the decision-making process. If you have, you know, kind of, it sounds like a very much, I'll use the word collegial. You know, if somebody needs you to give a look at an equity strategy, regardless of where it falls, you'll take a look at it. What's the decision-making process like, especially when it comes to, you know, two things? They go together, manager selection and portfolio construction.
On manager selection, obviously, we've been doing this for some time, so we know a majority of the players. Let's say I'm taking hedge funds as an example again. Let's say I'm looking at fixed income RV. At this point, we have a fairly good idea of who the players are in that space. So if we hear of any newer player entering the field, we would then look into that strategy, that particular manager in the context of the others that already have been in that space for a while. And the way the selection process probably, I think that is usually how it starts. Somebody identifies a manager that's worth taking a look at, and they will on their own have an initial call with them. Then the next step would be if they think that this is something that is worth pursuing, we would check and see whether there are any existing intelligence on them within in the past, whether somebody on our team has talked to them or if we've connected with them in some capacity or the other. And if after all of that, it still looks attractive, then we will have another call with that manager across the entire team. So the entire team will then at that point join the call with the manager and listen to the pitch. Once that call is over, we will then sit down as a team and discuss the manager and make a decision. Do we go forward with the initial diligence on it, which is probably the best way to think of it it's a short DDQ kind of a thing that we ask the manager to fill out, which has fairly basic information regarding the strategy, performance, team, ownership of the fund, that sort of thing. And then when that comes back, we will go through it as well as run a quantitative report on our side to assess whether or not this manager represents market risk or idiosyncratic risk. If so, what is, if there is some market exposure, the degree to which that market exposure exists. And then we will also run factor analysis on, for hedge funds at least, we run factor analysis to determine what are the alternative factors. Does the trend factor influence returns? Or try to attribute some of the returns to some of the alternative factors that exist in models like the Fang-Se model or models that resemble that sort of thing. On the basis of all of that information, we will make a decision as to if this is worthy of entering the deep diligence stage. If that determination is made at the deep diligence stage, we will reach out to the manager and ask for their DDQ, ask if they don't have one that is to our liking, we'll ask them to fill out our AMA DDQ, and then we will ask for all the attribution, the risk reporting, the newsletters, any other material that they may have. Based on that, we would review everything and come up with questions that we have to answer. At that stage, we will be sure to make a visit in person to the manager offices, wherever that may be, and go through I was in Asia a few weeks ago. We spoke with four prospective managers there, and with each, we spent 4 to 5 hours going over everything that we had questions about, meeting all of the team. It's not always possible to meet with everybody, but for sure, meet with the risk manager, the CIO. Sometimes we will even take the time to go over their risk system, see what kind of risk system they use. And based on all of that, we would then come up with a recommendation first, which is presented to the internal team within our asset class. And if it passes muster, it will then go through the approval process to our CIO and executive director. I will say this, that we have a pretty favorable governance structure. The manager selection actually is determined by staff with the CIO's sign-off.
So there's empowerment of staff.
Correct. And I truly appreciate that because I have talked to other peers who have to sometimes present to a lay committee and so on and so forth, which has its own complications. I'm sure you're familiar with that.
Oh, yeah. Yep. But just a quick follow-up. This is an unsurprisingly extensive process, a public fund fiduciary. It's not like you're just going to flip a coin.
Right. Correct.
So how long does it take to go through this, assuming the manager is responsive?
Yeah. Right? So the diligence phase will usually last 3 to 4 months. Sometimes it may be a little more accelerated if it's somebody we've been following for a while. This, in fact, happened in the case of a convert strategy that we invested in. We'd been following that manager for a while. We didn't invest with them initially because of some organizational issues. Once those were solved, we were able to move fairly quickly. So there are some exceptions, but normally I would say 3 to 4 months.
The second piece is, I believe you use outside consultants.
Correct.
As well as your internal resources. I mean, how do they participate in this process? And I'm focusing only now about, you know, the manager process, not the whole governance structure or the investment. I mean, how does it work?
Angelo, I think it's fair to say we view consultants as an extension of staff for the purpose of investment decision making. They don't really serve a gatekeeping role, though they may suggest we talk to XYZ funds since they know they will know what type of manager we are looking for at a given time, but they're not gatekeepers in any sense of the term. What the consultant does in concrete terms is provide us with an investment diligence report and an operations diligence report. Let me emphasize, we don't do our diligence work in concert, but we sort of do them in parallel. They do their work, we do ours. Not to say that we wouldn't compare notes on the way, but the diligence process is completely independent. Now, turning to the operations report, there I would say we are more dependent on the consultants because they have the resources and specialists that you need for to look into operations of, let's say, a hedge fund strategy, which we don't really have in-house, so we would tend to rely on that a lot more. One other thing that we absolutely need from the consultant is what we call a prudent person opinion on a fund. Basically, what that is, it certifies that this XYZ fund manager is of institutional quality. It is not that they agree that this is the best investment strategy since sliced bread or anything like that, but they have to certify it is of institutional quality.
Given you've been in the game a long time, do you also talk to some of your peers and other allocators, just to kind of get a feel in the
absolutely,
network?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We will talk to not only our peers, we have at this point a fair amount of contacts in the fund of funds industry. So we will talk to them regarding what their experience may have been, how the manager treats their LPs, and whether they have what their experience has been in the tenure of their investment with them, so on and so forth. We will dig into that. Absolutely. That is a key part of the diligence process. I mean, we will do it both formally and informally. We will ask for references. I would classify as our formal references check, but then we will informally also reach out and try and find people that, especially somebody who may have been invested and is no longer invested. That is actually often the most interesting kind of reference call. And it's not that they dislike the strategy. Quite often, it may be some reason, portfolio reallocation and whatever it may be. But it's always interesting to get that additional depth from folks like that.
I was talking to one of your peers yesterday, and we were kind of just, exchanging some ideas about, kind of the sourcing process, the vetting process. And he came up with an axiom that kind of stuck with me. And he said, access is not an investment thesis. You know, where people kind of pressure you, oh, there's a famous manager, you could get in this fund, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I mean, that seems to resonate with you that access is not an investment thesis.
Absolutely not. I mean, if you have a case like that where this manager is very well known. I mean, the decision structure is really something we take very seriously. So if it's one star manager doing all of the investment decision making, that in some sense raises the need for really diving really deep into how is that manager doing this? Are others contributing, or is he just he or she making the decisions on basis of whatever information he may gather on their own? That actually is a flag for us to really delve into the details of the decision-making structure for a fund.
I want to get a little concrete here and give you a hypothetical. So let's say I'm running a market-neutral commodity strategy. And at a high level, prima facie, it meets those criteria that you mentioned earlier in terms of 0.5 and drawdown, et cetera. Let's also assume I've got a 5-year auditable track record. And make it simple, I'm trading futures. So, you know, that's easy in terms of pricing and valuation. I've also got AUM that's enough to take $100 million. I'm going to pass your due diligence processes, both for you internally and the manager. Just grant me that. But my model is a fully autonomous black box. And say it's built entirely on deep reinforcement learning. No human in the loop. There's good guardrails. No human in the loop. Genuine interest or a hard pass?
As an institutional allocator, my answer would be it's not a hard pass, but the burden of proof becomes dramatically higher. For quant AI-driven managers, the bar for governance, robustness, and explainability rises sharply when something like AI is core to the strategy. Look, ultimately, allocators like us are underwriting how strategy or manager behave under uncertainty. The technology that they use is secondary to that, if be it AI, be it fundamental, whatever it may. At the end of the day, what we need to know as allocators is what drives under or outperformance. Since this is something we have to explain to powers that be, we're likely to ask, okay, what is the economic results for these results that you're showing me? And if I or whoever it is can't do that, then that is ultimately the test I would apply to the kind of strategy that you outlined. If I can't provide that, then yes, I would pass on it.
So it's what drives performance. And I'm going to add something that I heard from another one of your peers. Is it repeatable? I mean, you have to have repeatability here.
Correct.
Right. I mean, that's the nature because you're betting on the future.
Right. Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. I would agree with that. On a systematic process, that repeatability is easier to, I would say. Sometimes, you know.
It should be.
Yeah. I mean, the one shout out I'll give to systematic strategies is that fundamental folks will sometimes say, oh, that's black box. And my answer is the biggest black box is between the years of a fundamental manager quite often. So let's not forget that either.
I've made that argument many times and people don't seem to listen. But let me set aside the black box case for a minute and go to a topic that you and I had spent some time discussing, and that is artificial intelligence. Without any names or any proprietary information, are the current managers in the portfolio, we could stay with hedge funds, for example, are they using AI?
Absolutely. I think from what we've been able to gather from most of them, they are not using AI to concoct new signals. Where they're using AI is how quickly they can bring an idea from conception to execution. That is where I think we have seen or heard that managers are getting the biggest bang for the buck on the investment side. Now, many of them have simplified and streamlined operations processes using AI, and I think that's fairly well documented, and so we don't need to go there. But gosh, the time one of our managers, in fact, said we can go from a conception of an idea to execution in literally 10 minutes if we wanted to.
I mean, that's impressive. But, you know, I'll tell you, as a guy who is on a team building deep reinforcement learning models, it takes a long time. And I think you know this from your academic training in terms of experimentation.
Right.
Because when you're building, you know, these large capacity neural nets, it's not like a quant model where you could go in, change a few variables.
Correct.
I mean, you got to run the whole experiment all over.
Yeah, you have to retune the thing over.
The parameters, the hyperparameters, it's got to start de novo. And I also heard a comment, you know, about a week ago, someone said to me when I asked this question, we were just talking, you know, privately, I said, are that you seeing managers using AI? And she said, AI is everywhere in the conversation, but nowhere in the execution. I mean, I think operational efficiency, but people are still waiting for managers to kind of take it more deeply into the decision-making process. You've been an institutional allocator, I think, since 2002. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And in dog years, it's a lot more. I know that. But what's the biggest change you've seen in the industry during your tenure?
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting question. I think my immediate reaction would be, today, the amount of information you have access to is way more than what was available readily back in 2002. Now you have all of the analytics, DDQ, return history, regulatory filings, alternative data, AI-generated summaries, all of that at your fingertips with minimal effort compared to back in the day when you had to show up at manager offices and request all of that stuff and then go through all of that manually and absorb all the information. And that is something that has changed dramatically today with the advent of AI and internet online availability of information. That is a huge positive change.
Okay.
On the negative side, I sometimes wonder whether this industry may have become too obsessed with what is measurable and maybe veering away from some of the things which are a lot more difficult to quantify, such as integrity, intellectual honesty, adaptability, curiosity, culture, and team dynamics. I mean, these are things which ultimately produce long-term success for a manager. Look, if you have an attractive anomaly that you're exploiting, I can guarantee you that'll get arbitraged or copied in no time flat. And so that's something I do think those immeasurables are extremely important, always were and always will be.
Could I trace the immeasurables back to your comments about site visits where you go? I mean, I'm sure you do more than simply meet with people because you're looking around.
Right.
You're getting a sense of the physical space.
Correct.
How people sit. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't be surprised, given your experience, if you weren't even talking to the receptionist or talking to an intern because you're in the coffee room getting a coffee. I mean, that's where you kind of pick up the ethos.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. To your comment, the first thing and one of the main reasons why we insist on a site visit is because we want to read body language.
Yeah.
That's number one. The number two thing is, how does a PM interact with the analyst? The tenor of the interaction tells us a lot, I think, about the nature of the team dynamics. Is if we see that the PM is constantly trying to herd the analysts towards certain topics or certain answers, then that would be a negative for us. And we often see that the PM or the CIO trying to dominate the whole delivery of information. And that, I mean, it's not that necessarily negative, but it's information that we need to process and understand.
Right.
And those are the kind of things we look for on a site visit, for sure.
You mentioned body language. Chris Schelling and I wrote an article years ago about using artificial intelligence in manager meetings, so you could pick up body language, you could pick up changes in blood flow to see if they're lying in their face. I mean, I'm not advocating this, and this was probably 5 years ago we did it, but it's the same thing. You've got to use every edge you can gain.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because your decisions, these are, in your space, these are illiquid investments.
Correct.
You own them. I mean, once you get in there, it's not like it's an ETF.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right, Angelo. I mean, it is something we will use any available information to make our decision.
Knowing what you know now, what's the one thing you would tell a younger allocator? No disrespect. I'm not saying you're old, but someone less seasoned, someone less seasoned than you, if they were just starting out, what's the one piece of advice you would give them? Because you've been gored by that ox many times.
Yeah. That is an excellent question. And just picking up from what we were discussing a minute ago, I would say spend less time trying to predict markets, more time trying to understand people, in terms of the manager and the teams that you are investing with. Secondly, understand your own biases and don't fall victim to them. Don't look for information just to reinforce that belief that you may have for whatever reason. Look for the cons to theses. And one question I always suggest people ask a manager is, talk about a major mistake that you made and what did you learn and change coming out of that mistake? That often gives you a very keen insight into the way the manager operates and processes information.
It also gives you some insight into the manager if it takes him a long time to come up with that, because we've all made
that too.
We've all made mistakes, and it's lessons learned, I think, is the way to look at it.
Correct. You know, because, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I've got my last question I ask everyone. You know what's coming. What's the worst pitch you ever heard?
So this was an equity manager who visited us in our offices many moons ago. They started their pitch about their investment strategy, and it was based on a quantitative equity model. Then we try to dig into it, question them about the model, and it turns out it's been put together by somebody who no longer worked there. So questions like, why did you outperform in year X or underperform in year Y? The answer was, we don't know. The model did it. That's my story.
I like it. Yep. Well, let me say, I've been asked that question about the deep reinforcement learning strategy, and I had to be honest and say the model worked.
Yeah.
But ours was a genuine black box. Yeah, it wasn't the result of any transitional human resources issues.
This was way before the advent of AI.
Well, this is great. I appreciate you reconnecting. Absolutely. And picking up the conversation. I got nothing else for you. I've exhausted 40 minutes of your time. Now you can go on and get some real work done before you go watch Spain.
Thank you, Angelo. Very nice chatting with you, and let's stay in touch.
We will.
Thanks for listening. And be sure to subscribe to the show on the podcast app of your choice and follow us on the Against Consensus YouTube channel. You can also find episodes at the Against Consensus website, and the show's episodes will be on FinNews' website. Also, it'd be great if you could follow us on LinkedIn. All the links are in the show notes. If you have someone who belongs in this conversation, an asset owner, an asset manager, a service provider, send them my way. If you represent an organization that wants to reach the most sophisticated audience in institutional investing, then let's talk about a sponsorship. And if you're an emerging manager with a genuinely differentiated investment approach, let's talk about creating a custom episode for you that can help you build your brand. And in case you're wondering, our music is provided by the Super Trio, courtesy of the Northrop family. No AI-generated music for us. Thank you for your support, and we'll see you next time. Namaste. All opinions expressed by hosts and guests are solely their own. The information presented in this podcast is for educational and informational purposes only. The host, guests, and their affiliated organizations are not providing investment, legal, tax, or financial advice. Investment strategies discussed may not be suitable for all investors, as individual circumstances may vary.
This episode is brought to you by Castos Productions.